Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the Lob podcast with These Football Times. My name is Stuart Horsfield, and once more we're going back into the centre circle, right into the thick of the midfield. And we're going to explore another book, and of course I'm delighted to say we've got the author of the book. It's an incredibly niche subject, but a very, very interesting subject, and certainly something that we talk about in terms of eras of football that we like to discuss. And it's great to sort of have a renowned expert. Obviously, no pressure on them once they get on here, but we're going to call them a renowned expert for now. But before I introduce the renowned expert and author, two not-so-renowned experts in some things, but they are in others, are the co-pilots for tonight. So first of all, Mr. Stephen Scraggs. Stephen, welcome. Long time no speak.
I know, it's been a bit of radio silence, hasn't it, the last couple of weeks? Hull's internet, communism has really kind of like set us back for the last couple of weeks. But, you know, within that, you know, I've been able to catch up with the wife and the kids.
Oh, excellent. Yeah, I've had to do a lot of just normal talking instead of down a microphone and to a
screen. Oh, yeah, it's been
kind of like, nice.
Yeah, it's kind of been nice. But, yeah, I've missed you all as well. But, you know, it's been kind of like, oh, yeah, this is what I used to do before, podcasts.
obviously, I can't decide whether we mentioned too much about Hull's internet, whether actually it'll get us preferential service or whether they'll just literally just cut my broadband. And then halfway through, that'll be it. We'll just be podcasting one night and everything will just go dark. And that'll be the end of it. But yeah, it's been a little while. You've got to be looking forward to this one tonight.
Oh, yes. This is absolutely spectacular. You know, that's such a... Just a great part of the world in football in terms, you know, so much mystery. And this is something I miss about contemporary football, is that sense of the unknown and finding out something that you don't know. You know, that all of that's been obliterated by the contemporary game and how you can watch absolutely anything, anywhere, whether that's, you know, legally or illegally. There are no surprises in football anymore. But this is... You know, tapping into that wonderful Iron Curtain era, and you know, all those wonderful players and those great names of teams, and yes, this is, you know, criminally undercovered, basically, as far as I'm concerned, and this just ticks every box for me.
It's like I said in the beginning, it's very much an undercovered area, but it is an area of such fascination and so many stories. And like you said, there always seems to be something to learn. I'm still not convinced that everything is out yet. So we'll ask about whether there's going to be a follow-up book when we're finished. But I'm still not convinced that everything is out about the football, like you say, behind the Iron Curtain from this era.
Oh, no, there's all sorts of... you know, this topic itself could be revisited in multiple approaches, but there's just so many other fascinating offshoots as well, all the way across, you know, behind the Iron Curtain and across the Eastern Bloc, as was everything about it is fascinating.
We'll move swiftly across to Spain. Gary, welcome
back. Yeah, it's good to be talking about football on a Sunday night with my mates, and well, a Thursday night, actually, not a Sunday night, Thursday night. And I've got a glass of beer, and I'm going to talk about football and a really terrific subject. And, you know, it's one of these things where, you know, as you guys were saying there, there's so many stories. It's a story-rich environment. And, you know, some of the names of the clubs when we were going through the book, you know, I remember, I was like, oh, yeah, you know, that one. It's one of these sort of, the names of clubs carries a certain sort of mystique, a almost like an otherworldly sort of nature. But what the book does really well is sort of bring those into reality and sort of presents them to you as, you know, I guess the supporters there are football supporters like as they are in Leipzig, as they are in Ludlow. And it's, the book's very good about doing that. It's very empathetic. And it's going to be a great chat tonight.
It is, and we talk about this all the time. We must bring it up probably once every three podcasts. But I'm convinced that football should somewhere fit into the national curriculum of geography, history and politics. And it's just such a great medium for learning. When I was reading this, it was almost the sort of the accompaniment to my, and Stephen will agree with this, it's the accompaniment to your childhood where you hear the names, you hear the teams, and you kind of learn where they are with regards to sort of the continent and geographically where they are. But this book sort of adds another layer to it that you kind of wish you'd had at school.
Oh, yeah. Completely. It really does. I mean, I fully agree with that. There's parts of the world and parts of this country that I live in that I don't know simply because they're not particularly touched by football. So yes, I know great swathes of kind of like Eastern Europe and behind the Iron Curtain that I wouldn't know otherwise if it wasn't for that interest in football.
I think it's almost like it strips another layer off. You know, it sort of lifts the cover of the Iron Curtain and lets us peek behind what was going on there. Obviously, a bit retrospective because the tour was sort of after the Iron Curtain fell. But even so, it still gives an ability to peek back into history and say underneath that Iron Curtain.
Like I say, we've got an expert, we've got the author. Let's get him on. Let's get him on. Let's have a chat. So the DDR Oberliga, an entity that existed for really just over four decades, a place and a wonder and a mystery that has criminally gone under-celebrated for far too long, the guys have mentioned already. But obviously now, tonight, we're going to be talking to the author of the excellent book, The Turning Season by Michael Wagg. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Stu. It's an absolute pleasure and a privilege to come on and chat to you. I'm looking forward to it.
Trust me, the pleasure and the privilege is all ours, literally. it's all ours. Just before we get started, it's funny. Sort of books come out, and especially as we've sort of been in lockdown, and there seems to be a sort of a going back to print and to books, and people seem to have got sort of more into reading. And I've sort of, over the last sort of 6 to 9 months, you catch wind of a title that's coming out, or you catch wind of a book that's coming out and a subject, and you think that goes in the basket, if you like, from wherever you're buying it from. And you think, yeah, can't wait. And your book, as soon as I read what it was about, it's like, yeah, this is going to be brilliant, this book. And it's the subject, as the guys have already mentioned, it's so fascinating. And you sort of, and all of a sudden, once you get wind of a book that's coming out about a subject that fascinates you, you sort of, I suppose it's a bit like Christmas, which is quite ironic, bearing in mind we're recording this in December, that you're sort of wishing the time away to the sort of the release of the book. And like I say, yours was for me one of those books where I was desperate to sort of get to release date so we could actually have a look at it. And then once you agreed to come on, then all the better.
Well, it's very kind of you to say so, Stu. Thank you. I mean, yeah, I guess we've all had an awful lot to deal with this year, but maybe there have been some strange upsides to the lockdown and so on. And I agree, a little bit more time, particularly for reading, might have been afforded to some people, obviously, depending on their circumstances. So that in one sense, maybe that's good time. And also, it was total coincidence that, that none of us knew what was coming, but I finished my journey, which I can talk more about in a moment, the sort of three legs of my journey, literally, I left Germany the day they locked down in Berlin. So I got out that day, and then within, I think it was 2 weeks later, we were in lockdown in the UK. But I was always, that next period from March up to June, when I had a deadline with Pitch, was always going to be the period where I was going to get the bulk of it written. So in that sort of slowing down and perhaps a bit more time to stop and think and take stock a little bit also coincided with the writing of the book, the business end of the writing of the book. So I felt quite fortunate in that. Obviously, there were lots of other worries that we've all had to deal with in that period. But in a strange sort of way, it was good timing.
Like you say, and it is pure, like you say, just sometimes the stars align or whatever you want to call it. And yes, there, you know, 2020 has been horrendous and continues to be so. Yeah. But there has been, like you say, this odd upturn or this odd sort of almost changing circumstance, changing situation where life seems to have just shifted that little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. just to pick up on, you've all said such kind things already, and I really appreciate it. But I wish now, Gary, I'd called the book From Leipzig to Ludlow. I think we've missed a trick, but maybe, I don't know, maybe there's a sequel which is From Leipzig to Ludlow. I'll keep that in mind. But
yeah, I should do that, mate. Yeah, yeah. There's no charge for that, by the way, Michael.
I'll have that. All right, thanks. And the other thing, this is just a silly thing. It was, I think that mine and Stephen's second book, I think, came out on the same day. And in it, which I think I'm right in saying that, Stephen.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, and in a silly way, you mentioned sort of getting drawn to names, and I'm a bit of a sucker for names and for silly names particularly. And I've got to hold my hand up and say my surname is a fairly silly word and not dissimilar to Stephen's, with the greatest respect, Stephen. So I was just tickled by the idea that Scraggy and Waggy's books were both published. And I think maybe we should consider, I don't know what it is, a duo of, are they hapless detectives?
It does sound like a budding 1980s crime detective series.
Yeah, maybe it's a Behind the Iron Curtain detective series.
Yeah. Traveling East Germany in a Trabant, solving assassination attempts on Eastern German players that have defected to the West.
We're on to a winner, I think.
Before you two guys go off solving closed case files in Eastern Europe, we'll chat about the book. Now, you know, I suppose, you know, the first question, the opening question that we always sort of, the two-part question that we always throw out there, what's the book about? Obviously, we've alluded to it a little bit, but, you know, from your perspective, you know, what do you see that the book's about? What's the, you know, sort of the key narrative or the strands that come off it? And arguably, maybe more importantly, more interestingly, more difficult to answer, is the why? What was the inspiration? Why this book?
The short answer, I guess, as to what it is, it describes a journey that I've made to visit the 14 cities that had a top flight football club in East Germany in the season 1989-90. At the start of that season, the Berlin Wall was standing firm as it had done for 28 years. And by the end of the season, in fact, shortly into the season, the Mauer fall had happened, the fall of the Berlin Wall had happened. East Germany was already on its last legs by then. But that football season continued. And so what I've done is, as I say, revisited the 14 cities that had a top flight football club in that particular season. 30 years ago, I wrote it up in the football season 2019-20. So it's exactly 30 years. And I wanted that sort of neatness. Don't ask me why, but that felt important to me. But I say visit the 14 cities because that was also important to me. It's not just the football clubs I'm writing about. In some way, I suppose I'm trying to write about the football clubs through the cities and vice versa, probably more so vice versa, probably write about the cities through the football club. And so it's a book about 14 cities or towns. It's a book about places, those 14 places. It's a book about 14 football clubs then and now. And I suppose in a less concrete way, I'm sort of chasing the footballing ghosts and the footballing stories of that time 30 years ago. But that season for me was the starting point in my thinking. So from that season, 1989-90, I'm sort of looking back into the history of the DDR Oberliga, which is the name of the top flight, the first division in East Germany, looking back through its 40-year history and looking forward from 1989-90 into reunification of Germany and the swallowing up of the East, and particularly in Eastern football by the West and the Bundesliga. So I'm looking forward and back from that point, from this point 30 years on, if that makes any sense. Why do that? There's probably a few disclaimers I should I was very flattered that you described me as a renowned expert. I'll take it.
It's yours.
But I'm not. And the most important thing to say is I was definitely not an expert when I started out. And in fact, I knew next to nothing about football in that region and that context. Probably actually nothing. So the book is also my journey of learning about that, because I knew there was something niggling away at me. And I, early in the book, I described something niggling away like a missed sitter. And there was something that had been with me for about 20 years, and I can explain where that sort of came from in a moment, but that drew me to learning about football in that context. The history, the stories, the culture, particularly as much the stories of what happened on the pitch as what happened off the pitch, what happens off the pitch around football clubs. So I was sort of drawn back to that time. And where that started for me, I write for theatre as well as about football. But I've also been an actor for nearly 20 years. And a great deal of my work, predominant part of my work, has been theatre and an awful lot of touring, an awful lot of back of the van, all the actors, all the set, all the costumes, all your luggage in the back of the van, a different town or city every day, a different theatre every night, pack up after the show, get in the van and go to the next place. Quite romantic type of work, type of touring. Also grueling and hard work and frustrating and all that. But a company that I worked with when I first started doing that sort of work as an actor was based in Munich. And I did three or four early, quite long tours, sort of 4 or 5, 6 month long tours all over Europe. But because the company was based in Germany, a good part of the tours were in Germany. And the first couple of tours I did, a large portion was in Eastern Germany, an area that I'd never been to before. And I just, right from that, and I cannot pinpoint what happened, but right from that moment, I was just drawn to that region. Everywhere I looked, I saw sort of a shabby, faded, romantic grandeur about the architecture and about the stuff around the street that I saw. And I just got fascinated and thought, I have to come back here if I the next chance I get on tour as a doing theatre work. But also, there's something about this place that I want to dig into a bit deeper. And I think I've heard Stephen mention sort of scratching an itch. I think the itch started on those early tours. So this is a long answer, by the way. You cut me off at any point, but fast forward about 10 years and I got more and more into lower league football, non-league football in the UK. And I'm a non-league football fan. That's where I get my football from. And that's become increasingly important to me. So there's some 10 years after that, as I started to think more seriously about writing something about football in that context, I've sort of wanted to bring the two things together. That is an unknowable fascination with the region and the history of Eastern Germany, I wanted to put that together with a love of knackered old football grounds and football clubs, particularly small ones playing at lower levels that are absolutely the beating heart of their communities. And I wanted to try and see if there was some connection or some way to look at one through the other. The even shorter answer to that, probably the most honest answer, is that I wanted to go back and do a tour of East Germany without having to do the flaming show every night, because it gets in the way. And I wanted to try and focus on the football. And I sort of explained that early on in the book. But I gave myself the challenge of learning about football in that context and of doing a tour, actually booking myself a tour. But the tour was of football clubs and their places. And place is the most important thing. I hope that ramble answers some of that.
It's not, to be fair, it's not a bad opener. We've had quite a few, we've had all sorts of different ones, but it sets the scene. I mean, it sets the scene perfectly, certainly about the book, but probably, like I say, for me, I'm always interested in why, you know, why people write the book, why they pick the subject that they write, you know, what's the, you know, some of it's just a genuine affection or a love of, sometimes it's a, you know, it's a little kernel of an idea that just, you know, it might actually just be an article, but it actually, you know, builds and builds and builds until, you know, there's a full book about it. But I guess, Stephen, you know, we were saying at the beginning before we sort of started recording, just sometimes, and Michael mentioned it there, you have this itch, but you can never really say what we, you know, when you, it's very rare you sort of start a book, say, I'm writing a book about this. I know a lot about this, so therefore I'm writing that. You know, like Michael's just said there, yes, I, you know, sort of introduced him as a renowned expert. And compared to the three of us, he arguably is. And he's very modest about it, but it's, you know, sometimes you're almost self-taught as well along the way. You're sort of writing your book, you find out so many things that you didn't know or you thought you knew that, you know, end up becoming myth or folklore and aren't actually true at all. And it's, you know, there can be a real voyage of discovery sometimes.
Yeah. So, sorry to jump in there, but for me, that went even further, actually, in the form that it was going to take. Because when, I've got to be honest, when I set off, I didn't know that it would be a non-fiction book-length piece of work. It, as you say, it could have been a series of articles or just one article. I write for theatre and I write poetry as well, so it could even have taken a very different form. It could have been a play, for example. It could have been a series of poems, and I didn't know what it was that I was going out. I knew that I was going out to learn and to explore and to have a good time, but I didn't know what form the writing would take. And I wanted both the stories that I found to suggest themselves to me when I got there, but also the form that it might take as a finished piece of work. Quite soon on, I thought, I think there's a book in that, but that's just a hunch. You know, you don't know whether that's going to be the case. But yeah, so I didn't know what form at all it would take when I set off. So it was very much exploring and discovery, as you say.
Stephen, it's quite, again, listen to that bit there from Michael. It's quite fascinating. I'm quite excited for the play version of your book on the European Cup, Stephen.
Oh yes, this is it's changed direction already. I'm impressed with this. Yes, it's a great idea. But no, what Michael's describing there, it's a very different version of what we know, because we don't really lean into. You know, I've never written poetry. I've never written a play. You know, Gary's written a novel. You know, so maybe he can attach himself better to that. But what I noticed there and I pick up on is the fact that Michael's the direction he's gone and what he said there, it's all leans towards a kind of instinct led writing. You know, it's allowing instinct to take over, and the best writing is that way inclined. It's not overly structured. It doesn't come up with a set of rules before the first word's written. And I find that a brilliant way to write a book. I find it a brilliant way to read a book. You know, and I think for me, reading Michael's book, I just found I read it very, very quickly. You know, some books take me a week or so to read, even a couple of weeks sometimes. You know, other things are on. I've got my own things to write. There's life going on. But this was one of those books where it was a case of, no, hang on, I'm just going to read this bit before I go and do that. You know, hang on, no, you're going to have to wait. I'm going to finish this bit and then I'm going to go do that. But everything that he's said there, you know, sounds so familiar, but from an alternative perspective almost.
Gary, Stephen's mentioned there about, you know, you've written a football fiction novel that was released, just recently, but do you think, I'm really sorry, I'm going to start the questions already. I've been off for a while. Do you think that the more untapped subjects, as you know, as we were sort of been mentioning in the intro, because there's not this sort of deluge of books and information out there, do you think they then lend themselves to be able to be, you know, sort of molded into it, not so much a different art form, but a way of, you know, would it be easier to sort of set Michael's book as a fictional novel as well, because there is so little known about it? Or do you think it's more difficult because there's so little known about it?
You're doing it again, haven't you, really?
I am really sorry.
It's a really good question. And I think the answer, I was sort of just mulling it over as you were talking, and I think the answer is probably yeah, because there's far more scope. And I'm really interested to hear Michael talk about, you know, his theatrical background, because it paints pictures really well in the book. I can see that. I can now it's also another oxide in the book. And it's interesting that, you know, he's got this, and Steve used the word really well, instinctive for writing about it. And it feels like it's something that, you know, when we do the sort of books we normally write, I won't say they're formulaic, but, you know, they're about games and they're about, you know, history. And this is about history, but it's also about the people as well. And, you know, I think it's important that it's got the two together, but also they're also separate as well. And you can understand one without actually needing to understand the other, although they are sort of intrinsically linked. But yeah, going back to what I think it does, yeah, it does lend itself to giving more latitude for for transmitting the information, to tell the story, paint the picture in a way that suits your sort of instincts.
Well done, Gary. Good, excellent response to the opening question.
Just to try and make it a bit more concrete. I'd hate the listeners to think, oh, he off he goes there, you know, says he's going to come back and write poems about it. Without wanting to get too hoity-toity about it, whatever the right word is, it was a bit more concrete, I guess, because I've written in other forms, it wasn't a given that this would take the form of, you know, a non-fiction chapter-by-chapter account. The only thing I knew for certain was that I probably didn't want to write a sort of conventional history of a football league. Nothing against those sorts of books, but I just didn't feel like I was the person to do that. And nor did I want to write the full history. There's a brilliant book about football in this context called The People's Game by Alan McDougall. It's exhaustive and brilliant and full of breadth and depth of learning. It's absolutely superb. And there was no, it's essentially an academic book. And there was no point in trying to rewrite that book. Maybe there was a point, but that wasn't what I set out to do. But then it becomes quite concrete, because when I go there, not knowing what the stories are, hoping that I'll find them, but also not knowing what the form is, that's not perhaps not as woolly as it sounds, because once I decided it was going to be written through as a non-fiction book, then all I'm deciding, I think, is what form does each chapter take, and what would bring alive the little bit of story that I discovered there. What options have I got? So to give that a bit more concrete explanation and example, the Berlin chapter ended up being basically a piece of fiction, basically a short story with a few different characters walking through Berlin in different directions, mainly from east to west, to different football matches at different times. And because I wanted to cover all the different times quickly, a sort of short story felt like the right framework for it. In another chapter, the Chemnitz chapter, Karl Marxstadt, I proposed marriage in Chemnitz some years ago, and we're still happily married, I can report, but that was where it happened, and I wanted to bring that in, but I didn't want to just bolt on a marriage proposal. So for better or worse, to use that sort of marriage phrase, I decided to sort of try and weave into a more conventional history of the football in Chemnitz a spoof, sort of pastiche spy thriller. So I'm a sort of spy on a mission, and the mission is to propose. Other of the chapters are a bit more like, I guess, like travel writing, like travelogue type writing. So, and then there's one chapter where I'm measuring the angle of the floodlights at Rottweil's Erfurt, which is a fairly daft thing to do. It wasn't that I was looking for great groundbreaking forms, far from it. I was just wondering, I was free, I guess, in each place to think, what's the story and how might I best write it up to bring my little experience of going to the place to life a little bit, if that makes any sense. And I was sort of, I felt free to do that, but also I was helped by the fact that I had a very tight structure in the first place, because I had these 14 places I had to go to. So the structure sort of already existed. It's 14 cities, it's 14 clubs. Because that structure was quite tight, I felt free to be a bit freer with what I might be writing up. And I hope that the result is not that it's neither one thing nor the other. I hope the result is that there's some variety in it and that it doesn't take itself too seriously, even when it sounds like it does, if that makes any sense at all.
It's funny actually, because I was just about to, like as you were saying there, Max, about to throw that back to Stephen. And I guess, you know, one of the sort of, you know, the charms of the book is very much that it's, you know, some you could look at it and be like, oh, Eastern Europe, you know, the intrigue, the Cold War, the politics, that, you know, is it going to get bogged down in sort of detail? And, you know, and like I say, football is a great medium for learning these types of subjects, but just sometimes they can be quite intense subjects to take on in volume, like say, you know, through a book. But like you said, Stephen, it's, you know, it's a book that you do struggle to put it down.
Oh, completely. I think as well as that, you don't have to tell everything. You know, I've mentioned this before. Sometimes with a topic, it can be one end of the spectrum or the other. You can have a topic that is well known, thus you don't really need to tell the obvious parts that everyone knows. You come at it from a different angle that maybe someone's not thought of before. Or if it's a topic that isn't so well known, you kind of almost, you know, you only really kind of go across the tip of the iceberg as such, but you leave little teasers there that might hopefully, you know, someone picks up that book and reads it and then puts it down and then thinks, I'm glad I know that now, but I also want to know more. You know, so it's almost kind of like you don't always have to go into, you know, you don't have to mine a topic to the deepest of depths as a, you know, an in-depth book, as Michael was saying, one of the books he mentioned earlier on about the topic. Forget the name of the book now. But
yeah, The People's Game.
Yeah, The People's Game. Yeah. That was it. You know, which does that, you know, and you, like Michael said, you don't have to kind of mimic that or to rewrite that. You know, you come at it from your own perspective and you it is very much your own interpretation of the topic. And for me, you know, that can be, you know, many faceted routes to do that, and all of them are valid. There's no wrong way to do this, and for me, you know, Michael's take on this has been a spectacular one. And you know, for me, I grew up on these teams and the wonder and the awe of them and these mysterious names that somehow felt or sounded a little bit dangerous almost and mysterious. So you know, for me, there's one of the feelings that it gave to me earlier on was when I read the opening pages and Michael mentions the concept of lower league football and non-league football. And so when I'm reading these early pages and it's the reference to these East German teams, and yes, he's coming at it from the perspective of kind of where they are now and how they've fallen since the 30 years that it's almost been since the Oberliga ended. But for me, somewhere, they're still teams that are locked in time. So for a split second or two, or maybe actually kind of like a couple of minutes, I was wondering who he was talking about, because for me, these teams are still up there on a pedestal for me. You know, they aren't lower league teams. I don't. It's almost like I don't consider them lower league teams. You know, I can draw a comparison to, say, a Nottingham Forest. You know, they're only on loan to the lower divisions. They still belong in the top division. You know, Leeds United winning promotion back to the Premier League felt like they'd returned home in some manner. You know, so these teams fall by the wayside, but not in an aesthetic sense to me. They stay there. So, yes, Lokomotiv Leipzig are down the divisions. Carl Zeiss Jena are down the divisions. But they're still prominent to me. So, you know, this was a wonderful kind of juxtaposition almost.
It's, go on.
You can also get, I think you touched on it there, Stephen, anyway, you can sort of get drawn in particularly to the names of these clubs and form great attachment to them from distance and across the years, can't you, as you say there?
Oh, you can. Like I say, for me, growing up in that era of Sports Night and Midweek Sports Special, and, you know, there'd be the European Cup, the Cup Winners' Cup, the UEFA Cup ties, and, you know, a British team would draw a team from behind the Iron Curtain and they would leave a lasting impression. Yeah. And because you could, it was the pre-internet era, you would only see these teams tip up, you know, periodically. This is why I have such an affinity to, like, Dinamo Tbilisi, for instance. and then you would look out for them at World Cups. But the thing was that the Soviet Union would tip up at World Cups and European Championships. You know, Yugoslavia would do that. East Germany wouldn't. You know, they reached the World Cup in 1974, but that was the year I was born. So, you know, I only know that from the record books or seeing the footage on TV. You know, I didn't live that. Early inklings of football, they narrowly missed out on qualifying for the 1980 European Championship. My knowledge of East Germany as a national football team was always a case of them having that capability to be dangerous on the day or on their evening, but not to be able to put it together over the course of a full qualifying campaign, for instance. So, the club sides were more than capable of upsetting a big side, but to put it together and reach a final. Reaching the Winners' Cup final in 87, Lokomotiv Leipzig, Carl Zeiss Jena reaching the 81 final, they were massive, massive things for me. And, you know, they've stayed with me all this time. And as the years go by, I'm mid-40s, but, I can still reach out to those teenage years and those childhood years and think they still feel like 5 minutes ago. And within that, that's why these teams remain relevant. And it goes back to that concept that we always go back to, and your most impressionable eras of football, what you absorbed and when you absorbed it is massively important to how much of an impact, not just in football, but it can be anything. It can be music, it can be literature, it's love, it's life, it's anything like that, it's friendship. It's when it happens and how much of an impact it makes.
I'm going to come to you again now, Gary, because this is something that we've looked at and we've talked about, certainly in the political football podcast that we've done. You know, we talk about sort of social history and oral history and sort of keeping stories alive. But I think, people, and Stephen's mentioned it there, in 74, East Germany get to the World Cup finals. But, essentially Michael's book's looking at a nation, it's looking at teams where the nation doesn't exist anymore. The country, East Germany as a country, does not exist anymore. And for sort of football fans that are, sort of younger, well, arguably younger than Gary, than Stephen and myself, it's almost a learning curve for a nation that certainly the students that I sort of work with on a daily basis are IT. It's a nation that has never existed in their lifetime. So the story and the book and the chapters and the way Michael tells them is so important in order to keep the stories alive, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it absolutely does. We've discussed sort of the importance of histories, about lesser known footballing centre, shall we say, in the past, being all of the histories all written history, because as you say, they're gone. And once they're gone, they're never coming back. But I just 74. 74 was a really sort of iconic year for German football, because not only Ajax lost the got knocked out of the European Cup for the first time in 4 years. They've got knocked out by CSKA Sofia. And Bayern Munich won the European Cup. And obviously, East Germany beat West Germany, but West Germany won the World Cup. But lost somewhere in that, to many people, is Magdeburg's triumph in the Cup Winners' Cup. And when we did the Germany mag, 12 months, 18 months ago now, I wrote about the Magdeburg triumph. And it was one of those things where, I think they played AC Milan in the final. I think Milan were the oldest. I think Trapattoni was manager there at the time. And it was AC Milan are playing this team you've never heard of. And, and Magdeburg beat them with that, and deservedly so. And there were managed by a guy called Heinz Krugel. I think the stadium was named after him. And Spalbasser played for them at the same time as well, the guy who scored the goal for East Germany against the West. And I'll always remember that result. And it was sort of tripped in my mind about, Magdeburg, who are these guys? And there you are again. It's the history that I'm old enough to remember that, but obviously a lot of people aren't. And it's a great story that should be told and should never be lost. And, it's books like Michael's that preserve that history.
And I suppose then, Michael, like you said, it's, and it was sort of a, not so much a labour of love, but, it's an interest that you had. It's, it was a passion that you had for that sort of area. In terms of, I suppose what you found out, you know, any preconceptions that you had of East German football going into this, and then whether or not they changed or whether they were reinforced as you went through this process.
Yeah, I was just, as Gary was talking there, I was just thinking again about 1974 particularly. It was an astonishing year for German football. Magdeburg won the Cup Winners' Cup. Bayern Munich won the European Cup. Germany won the World Cup. And I could have got this wrong because I've got a hopeless memory for some of this, but Lokomotiv Leipzig got to the semi-final of, you would know this, Stephen, of the UEFA Cup, didn't they? Is that the year that yes. Tottenham beat Leipzig in the semi-final?
That's right, yeah, 74 when Tottenham went on to lose the final to Feyenoord.
Yeah.
They'd beaten Bobby Robson's Ipswich in the quarterfinals. I think that went to penalties. So it was a narrow one. But yeah, they were a dangerous side.
Yeah,
especially good in cup competitions. And they took to Europe very, very readily. And you don't go into the perils of Dynamo Berlin quite so much in the book, quite rightly. But yeah, you look at, they were almost like the anti-Dynamo Berlin, you know. So yeah, yeah. This affinity, and I think I always remember them tipping up on things like the Saints and Greavesy or On the Ball or Football Focus, because they, in European weeks, they would show kind of like the best goals. So you know, on Sports Night and Midweek Sports Special, you would get in-depth highlights of kind of like the games that the British teams had played, but then you'd get like extras on a Saturday afternoon where, you know, goals would be showed. And this is where, you know, I picked up a lot of my knowledge of these teams, because, you know, Lokomotiv Leipzig's European exploits, you know, always stuck in the mind. It's like Dundee United, you know, my kind of like, if I've got a soft spot for a Scottish team, that's who it is. And it's based upon that, like, early 1980s side that did so well, and how Paul Sturrock or Eamon Bannon used to score these screamers that, you know, were always shown on Football Focus every Saturday. So it comes down to that impressionable era. And yes, Lokomotiv Leipzig couldn't win a league title. They couldn't come anywhere near him winning the Oberliga. But, you know, take away kind of like the shackles of domestic hegemony and any sleight of hand that was going on. And they thrived. Yeah. You know, wonderful, wonderful team. And I think, you know, you see what's going on in football terms in Leipzig now. Whether that's, you know, a fan of it or not, you know, if you know nothing about Lokomotiv Leipzig, you know, go and have a look at it.
Yeah, but just imagine if they had beaten Spurs in that semi-final, they would have had the whole hall, wouldn't they? The Germans.
Yes, they would have
been some year.
You know, and the fact that, you know, the supporters that, I mean, I'd look at the 87. Cup Winners' Cup semi-final when they play Bordeaux and it goes to penalties and it's the goalkeeper that scores the decisive penalty. There's kind of like 100,000 in the Central Stadium. It's absolutely epic. You know, those games there that were played in Leipzig, the national team as well, you know, there's a wonderfully evocative game that they slip up in, and it was a qualifier for the 1980 European Championship against the Netherlands that they needed to win to reach the finals. And they led 2-0 and then lost 3-2. And, you know, it's the big near miss of reaching another major tournament. Yeah. But yeah, you know, it's the atmosphere, it's the intimidation that's thrown down. But it's, as part of it, there's sheer love within it as well. You know, the support for their own team, and I think with East Germany, it's all the more evocative because of that lack of a, you know, beyond 1974, the lack of a snapshot image in the mind of them playing in a major tournament that you do have with the Soviet Union, that you are permitted to have for Czechoslovakia and Yugoslavia, Hungary, Romania, so many of those nations across the Eastern Bloc. But not East Germany. It just adds that little bit more of a mystique to them.
Yeah, and to follow on and try and answer your question, Stu, that I guess one of the not preconceptions, but things that surprised me when I got out there on these trips is this European the history of big European nights. Of course, if I'd stopped to think about it in more detail before I went, it's obvious because that's a European country, and they're going to qualify for the three. They're going to have representatives in the three major UEFA tournaments. But I hadn't really thought about it that way. I thought I was going to small local clubs that once were a first division club in a country that now no longer exists. So, and now they're small community clubs, and many of them are. But even those small ones have this incredible history, many of them do, of European club football nights. For example, a strange is probably a better way to describe the town, the city, in the Far East on the Polish border is a place called Eisenhüttenstadt, and they had a team in DDR time called Stahl Eisenhüttenstadt. It was a massive steelworks, and in fact it was basically a Soviet new town built around a huge steelworks. But of course, if you've got a steelworks and a new town, you need a football club to represent that town. And I don't know how, but they managed to get to the top flight, to the DDR Oberliga. And not only that, in the very last season, when it had a slightly different name, the season 1990-91, which was the season where all the Bundesliga places were up grabs in a reunified German system. But in that last season, remarkably, Stahl Eisenhüttenstadt got to the cup final. They lost it, but Dynamo Dresden won the double, which meant that Stahl Eisenhüttenstadt, in the first year of reunified German football, found themselves in the European Cup Winners' Cup, facing in the first round Galatasaray. So I mean, it was those sorts of fixtures that I really didn't expect to find. And of course, I shouldn't have been surprised, but the fact of the matter is I was surprised. So I think about that, Eisenhüttenstadt against Galatasaray, another tiny club who I don't think ever got to the top flight, the DDR Oberliga, Schwerin, up in the north of what was East Germany. They also got to the Cup Winners' Cup. They qualified for the Cup Winners' Cup, due to getting to the cup final, the domestic cup final. But at that time, they were a second division club, and they finished that season 14th in the second division, and then found themselves the next year playing against, maybe Austria Vienna, I'd have to check, in the Cup Winners' Cup. So again, sort of remarkable experience for some of these clubs. And as Stephen rightly says, the East German fans didn't have much to cheer about beyond Olympic competition, and actually some Olympic medals for the national team. So these European nights that not all of the clubs had, obviously, but many of them did, become a massive part of their history and their story. And they're still talked about very much. So when I approached these clubs and wandered haplessly and aimlessly around some of these grounds and tried to chat to people, A, people were on the whole extremely friendly and welcoming. B, they were quite amused and a bit bemused as to what this strange bloke was doing, asking stupid questions. But when they started to get an idea of what it was that I was looking at and that I was trying to find some stories about the history of their football club, it was the European nights that came up the quickest, the big European nights, and they hang on to them. And particularly to some of the friendships formed between clubs. Obviously, they do worldwide, and there's often fairly random reasons for those friendships. And one of the strongest reasons, I think, is because they played each other at some point in the first round of one of the European club competitions. For example, Carl Zeiss Jena have a friendship with Newport County because they beat them on the way to the final of the Cup Winners' Cup in 81. And that friendship, when you go to Carl Zeiss Jena now, you'll see a Newport County flag. So those European nights mean a lot. And are fondly remembered, and quite rightly so. They're as Gary says, they're sort of amazing stories. And Magdeburg, particularly, to get back to 74, is quite a remarkable achievement to win. And they are the only club from the former East Germany to win a major European club competition, beating AC Milan, as you say.
Gary, sort of, I suppose, touching on the political aspect of it, you know, again, which is what certainly you and I tend to do. And that's, you know, the guys there, you know, Michael and Stephen mentioned about sort of the prestige and the esteem that the European nights are sort of held in. But it comes back to sport, and in particular football, as a form of propaganda in terms of, you know, obviously we're in the Cold War. you know, it's Stasi state-controlled sport, and it's an opportunity for a small nation to demonstrate, you know, its power or its might on a, well, in this case, on a European stage, certainly to Western Europe. It kind of just sort of reinforces again this, you know, how football is used as a political tool, and has done for as long as the game's existed.
Definitely, mate, yeah. But just touch on what Mark was just mentioned earlier about the Newport Guernsey Carlsruhe connection. I wrote a piece about it a while ago called When Before They Were Mighty, and the relationship is really deep, and they played a number of friendlies afterwards in sort of like a true friendly basis. But yes, excuse me, sport was one of the avenues open to the Eastern Bloc and East Germany in particular to prove the efficacy of the communist way. And obviously there was a lot of scandals about drugs on the athletes in track and field. And also, obviously, the big propaganda victory was when East Germany beat West Germany in the 1974 World Cup. And it's something that, when I was sort of doing research on about that, because I'm going to write a bit of that one as well, that the East German people were sort of looking for the West Germans to beat them rather than, because they didn't want the this repressive regime to triumph. It was almost like they're looking, you know, to say, you know, you're not all powerful as you think you are. But you mentioned the Stasi and the dynamo clubs across Eastern Europe were sort of linked to the secret police or the Stasi in East Germany, but obviously had different names of the countries. And the propaganda there was obviously like an internal thing as opposed to the external success. And political consideration, political expediency was always a major issue with these sort of things. And, the success that they had, say, East Germany had in the 1974 with Magdeburg as well, was such a boost to the regimes in the Eastern Bloc, particularly in East Germany.
It's a subject that, and it's part of the mystique, I guess, that we sort of talked about at the beginning, Michael, and Stephen mentioned as well. And, you know, you talk about, or you mentioned there about talking to people about their club, talking to people about the history of their club. Was there, I'm not saying was there a reluctance to talk, but this is purely my ignorance, but also my genuine interest at the same time. And that's how willing people were to talk about the regime that was in place during the sort of time where your book is sort of based and your primary research was about.
Yeah, I think that on the one hand, the answer is my general experience was, as I say, that people were very kind, very generous with their time, very, very welcoming. That's the sort of broad picture of my experience. But also in terms of actually asking questions, it's difficult because I speak nowhere near good enough German for that to be, for this book to have been a sensible idea in the first place, or a practical situation. But anyway, so that's to my shame that I was speaking English on the whole. So that makes it obviously difficult to. In many of the places I had a good friend with me who would translate, and some of the clubs provided translators. But when we could talk, and when I managed to, and often people were very happy to talk, but it's really complicated, and I don't think I was trying to get to the heart of that situation, particularly in relation to Stasi and informing and those stories. I wasn't trying to delve too deeply into that, but people's response to that is very complicated. It also has hindsight involved in it now, as people look back. Stories aren't, we don't always remember things exactly as they were. There may be other reasons for that memory. So people's response is complicated on the one hand. It's very various depending on who you're talking to. So I got lots of different impressions, I guess, in that sense. In terms of, to try and narrow that down a bit, I guess something like the East Germany v West Germany World Cup fixture. You know, most people were happy to, of course, were free to talk about that, happy to talk about that. But a range from some people saying, I cheered for West Germany. It was as simple as that. I didn't want, I didn't believe in the state that I lived in, and I didn't support it. So I cheer West Germany. And others saw that as more along the lines, I guess, as what they described as ambassadors in muddy boots. So, a support of the system. And I got a whole range of response on that. But it's really complicated. And it wasn't the story, it wasn't the book that I was trying to write. I wasn't trying to analyse that political system or even its in detail its relationship to sport and football. And I think it depends who you're talking to is the sort of crude answer. I'm not trying to dodge it, but I don't think I know enough to be able to answer in more detail. I a common response when I talked about supporting whatever club I was at was that many fans, I think probably fair to say, particularly the younger fans at the time, so in the 80s, had two clubs. They followed two clubs, one in the East and one in the West. And that was very common. So that, of course, gets complicated if they're drawn against each other in European fixtures or whatever. And someone told me a story of they were a Dynamo Dresden fan, but they had always also followed HSV, Hamburg. And shortly after the wall fell, they played each other, I think in a friendly, and there were free tickets for people from the East. This guy went along with his two scarves. And that situation, he realised there was some absurdity in that situation. He soon decided to discard the Hamburg scarf, and then after reunification, stick with his hometown team. So things changed after then. A situation which, I don't know, in some cases was simpler. You could follow two teams or one from your side of the wall and one and or one from the other. So lots of stories, but I think supporting two teams is one of the common ones. But as I say, I also spoke to people who absolutely supported West Germany in that 74 match. That's true.
I suppose I'm going to jump back to you, Gary, here, because I've got another difficult question, but I think you're going to be okay with it.
Okay.
When you have a nation like this and you have this, you know, Michael sort of touched there that the book wasn't necessarily, or mine wasn't, you know, about the sort of state sponsor of sport. It wasn't about the relationships between the political and the football club, but it's just a question that came to that. I'm just quite interested in your opinion, really. When you have a country like that, when you have a country that is so dominated politically and it sort of seeps into every element and every aspect of life, do you think you get to see the true potential of that team, as in, you know, the East German national team or the club sides? You know, were they actually as good as they could be and actually exceeded because of what happened, or did they not achieve the potential that had they have lived under a freer regime that they could maybe have reached?
Good question. I guess what they didn't have is the quality facilities perhaps that were in the West. I mean, you know, obviously they've got the regime supported sport because they wanted to reflect well on the regime. But I guess perhaps the other thing, perhaps there wasn't the with the national team, perhaps there wasn't the love, shall we say. I mean, I'm not sure that's the right word. The national pride, perhaps. You know, interesting. Michael said there about some people who he spoke to, you know, wanted the regime to lose, wanted the East Germany to lose and supported the West right again in that game. I'm sure that, you know, there's a sort of a whole gamut of emotions across that sort of thing. I mean, you know, my sort of inclination is to think, you know, what you're saying must be true, but it's difficult to actually sort of try and sort of pin down the reasons why. As I say, perhaps, you know, the quality of the coaching, perhaps the quality of the facilities, perhaps the money they were or weren't earning, perhaps was also a factor. And I know Sparvasser, when he's interviewed after he scored the goal that beat West Germany, and he said, you know, I think he got the price of a car or something like that. And we're talking an East German car. We're not talking, you know, a Porsche or a Ferrari like the Premier League stars drive about. But the rewards weren't as great for the East German players as they would have been for the West Germans. So that's probably a factor as well. But I guess, you know, I'm sort of leaning towards thinking that there was a sort of less of an emotional drive. Whether that's true or whether that's me sort of having a jaundiced Western look into East Germany and sort of with Western eyes. Interesting what Michael thinks about that, Stu.
Yeah, I was just going to jump in. I guess also it might also be as simple as the fact that they did only qualify for that one World Cup. Maybe things could have been different. I think there were three occasions where the national team failed to qualify for a major tournament by only 1 point, and a couple of other occasions when they failed to qualify by 2 points. They were very close, and they also did do well. They were a decent national team in Olympic tournament. Obviously, things are different, and up until 88, I think it was amateur teams in football. So the competition is different, but they won a gold, a silver and two bronzes, I think, at Olympic football. But if they had got to another World Cup, maybe that story would have been slightly different. I don't know. In terms of the state pushing it, my general and again, quite crude sort of understanding of it is that it, broadly and for most of the time, the emphasis was on particularly on individual sports in Olympics thinking now, developing sports where individuals could win lots and lots of medals. And that, you know, that's not the case for football. There's only one gold medal up for grabs. So there was a lot of time when there was less emphasis put on the football. And then a few periods, one in the 50s and then one in the 60s, in 66 actually, where they suddenly, the sports authorities got very serious about football, restructured, made 11 what they called FCs, which is focus clubs. 11 clubs became the absolute focus to try and get those clubs more successful in European club competition, but also the main aim, I think, to get into the World Cup or the European Championship. And that did work in the end in 74. So I felt like they had certain times where they pushed it, but probably not enough. And they were a bit more interested in a haul of individual Olympic medals. That's my sort of crude understanding of that. But it could have been so different. I guess the upshot is that as we go where we were a moment ago, I guess, that those glorious European club nights become even more important. If all you've got is the Spavas, a goal apart from that, you know.
I suppose then, you know, Stephen, might as well sort of throw your opinions into this, you know, into this question as well. This, you know, did we actually see the, in your opinion, did we actually see the best of East German football in this period? I know it's difficult to answer and it's opinion based. I get that. But in terms of your opinion, did we get the best version?
Probably yes. I mean, it wasn't an expansive market, really. You know, you're not looking at an influx of foreign players, not even on the basis of kind of like the era where, you know, you look at Serie A at the time where there was two and then three foreign players were allowed. So there's none of that. Everything is derived from domestic players. And within that, it's what, about a quarter of the unified Germany, basically. So, you know, yes, they probably did the best they could. You know, they climbed the mountain as far as 1974 was concerned. The Magdeburg side that won the Cup Winners' Cup deservedly won it. You know, at face value, when you look at the record books, you think, good God, Magdeburg beat AC Milan. But that was a Magdeburg side that had won the Oberliga, I think did the double that season. They had the best part of 4 weeks to build up to that final. It was an AC Milan that, while they were being led by Giovanni Trapattoni, it was only about his fourth game in charge of the club. They were a club in disarray. They parted company with, I think it was Cesare Maldini. So, you know, this was a result that was ripe for the picking, as odd as it looks from a four decade detachment. But and then you've got the World Cup, and you know they beat West Germany and progressed to the second round of the World Cup, top of the group. And it's the amazing thing about that game and how that sense of pride kind of takes over, because the winner is kind of cursed. You know, it's the runner-up that gets the easier route to the final from there. But it is still, a political and sporting need to win that game. You know, you can look at the teams of the 1980s and that run of Lokomotive Leipzig to the Cup Winners' Cup final in 87, Carl Zeiss in 81. You know, as Michael said, yes, Leipzig have been there before, as reaching the semi-finals in 74. and given Spurs two very hard games and beaten a very talented Ipswich side on the way to that run to the last four. So yes, these sides had, you know, come together as a very national side, a very, you know, a team that was derived from the sum parts of what they had to build their football from. You know, you can try and draw parallels, but there's not many there to draw in so many ways.
It's and I suppose, Gary, I was just going to say, Gary, I guess, you know, when a nation is, you know, has such a relatively short sort of time span, I guess it kind of condenses those key moments. And, you know, as Michael said, it's the Cup Winners' Cup win. It's, you know, it's the game against West Germany in 74. Everything becomes far more magnified because it's such a shorter period of time.
Oh, sorry. I'd just throw into there as well as the difficulties for East Germany is that it's all very parochial and on the doorstep. You know, you can't compare them to Yugoslavia and the drawing together of Serbian and Bosnian and Croatian parts of what was Yugoslavia, or the Soviet Union picking off Ukraine and Georgia and all of this talent of a vast land mass. You know, this isn't even Czechoslovakia and drawing from the Czech side and the Slovak side. This is East Germany, a highly partitioned part of what used to be a completely different unified country. Sorry to interrupt there.
No, it's fine. Yeah, like I was saying, as I say, Gary, you know, it kind of magnifies, doesn't it? When you're such a relatively young, or the nation's been in existence, you know, for essentially a very short span of time, everything becomes a lot more magnified in terms of performances and moments.
Yeah, it does. And you know, they had a lot of, both the clubs and the national team, excuse me, all these sorts of so close, so near, so far moments. You mentioned talking about Leipzig in the UEFA Cup recently, but just going back to that sort of game we talked about earlier when East Germany played the Netherlands in the last game of the qualifying for the 1980 UEFA Cup, European Championships. And I sort of looked at this game when I was writing my Dutch book, and it's a sort of pivotal game for the Dutch. Jan Zwartkruis had taken over the control of the team after Happel left in 78. And he took a really young team to Leipzig for that game, and virtually 9,500 fans absolutely rammed the stadium. And half an hour into the game, the Germans were 2-0 up, and it was this you know, they were cantering through, and yet they managed to lose 3-2. And I think Franz Tyson scored, and I know Willy van der Kerkhoff got the winner towards the end. But the Germans had played so well in that group, and they had the two top goal scorers. A couple of weeks earlier, they'd spanked Switzerland something like 5-1, 5-2, something like that. Got a draw in Poland, and it's almost like they've done all the hard work. And I say Hoffman, I think was top scorer and strike in the tournament. But when it came to the important, the big step to get the job done, to get over the line, they fell away. And you know, even when 74, when East Germany went through West Germany, it was almost like, well, that's it now. And they got to the second stage groups. They seemed to lack interest. Like, you know, that's it. We've done now. We did what we had to do. So let's go back home. And whether it's lack of ambition or that killer instinct, I don't know. But there was something there, both with the clubs and with the national team as well. And the Magdeburg success was an exception rather than the sort of example of the starting point, the kicking off point.
It's, I mean, you know, guys, we've been, you know, we're well over the hour already, as I kind of knew we would be. But I guess sort of, you know, before we close it, you know, it's really important, Michael, that you sort of bring us up to date with sort of what you found while you were there, you know, the health and state, you know, of these clubs. You know, did you, on your sort of last minute, did you walk away feeling content about the future of these clubs, or is there any sort of, because I guess you must have sort of developed a deep affection for these clubs and these teams and these fans that you've visited. You know, have you sort of walked away content with their future direction, or, you know, or do you have concerns?
Yeah, that's a big one, I think. On the one hand, as I've said a couple of times now, because it's so important, I was met with such kindness and hospitality. and met lots of people who will remain friends, I think. So, of course, I came away with that feeling predominantly. And the clubs are the sums of the parts of the people who are involved with them, and particularly the fans. As I said, I'm as interested and as passionate about what happens off the pitch as on it. This period we're going through at the moment shows us more starkly than ever that the football is nothing without fans. And I sort of went out there with this concept, this vague idea in my head that I was chasing ghosts, particularly the ghost of Jürgen Schwarbach, actually, who I hasten to add is still alive, but I'm using ghost, I guess, as a more poetic way, if you'll forgive me. But then the idea of ghost matches has become very, very real. Geisterspiele is the German word for behind closed doors matches. So that the importance of fans to these clubs remains absolutely to the fore for me. And my experience of meeting some really lovely people is absolutely to the fore. But the reality is that many of these clubs are smaller clubs. They're all playing at a lower level. None of them are playing in the top division in Germany. Esgebirge Aue, remarkably, because it's Aue is quite a small town, a very small mining town. It is the highest placed of these 14 clubs. It plays in the second Bundesliga, the Zweite Bundesliga. And they're the highest placed, and all the clubs are playing at a lower level. And about half of them are playing, half of the 14, roughly, I'd have to double check where they are this season, but are playing in regional and semi-professional football, as opposed to anything from the three league or up, which is the national and professional game in Germany. So they're all small clubs, and clubs at the lower levels of leagues across the world, it's really hard, and obviously massively hard in this particular period when you can't get fans through the gates or fan numbers are limited. So I worry for all the clubs, and I worry in fact for on that level for lower league clubs everywhere. So I don't think that's any different. They're still trying to keep up. They're still struggling to keep up, I feel, generally with the West. So that's an added stress and difficulty. But as much as I worry for them, the clubs are I don't know, they are, I can't find the right word, but they are the people. To give it, I guess, a sort of communist feel, socialist feel, let's say, the clubs are nothing without the people, and they will survive somehow, because the people won't let them die. And they might reform some of these clubs. Rot-Weiss Erfurt, while I was there, went into administration, insolvency. They've restarted at the fifth level. Many of these clubs have had to merge with other clubs or reform in a different shape, but the people will make it. I feel confident that people need their local football club, particularly in a lot of these towns where, you know, some of these economically, they're not as strong as many of the cities elsewhere in the West and the big cities in the East. So these towns need their football clubs, and they'll survive on that level. Again, sorry for a slightly woolly answer on that, but if anything, I believe passionately that the people will make sure they've got their local football team, because it's vital. It's as vital as water and beer.
Michael, you know, it was a great answer. It's a great way to finish. But I'll come to Stephen and Gary, you know, with sort of comments for that as well, about, you know, their sort of thoughts on former Eastern European nations or football, or I suppose the sort of the swallowing up by Germany as a whole and the swallowing up by the Soviet Union, and we'll sort of round it out there. Is that okay? So I'll come to you then, Stephen. You know, obviously with what Michael's just sort of said there about, you know, about and what is a very real sort of fear, and I guess it's not, you know, with the current situation and current circumstance, it's not just sort of the former East German clubs that are feeling this at the moment. You know, it's clubs, I guess, all around the world. But I suppose, you know, there is this element that those former East German clubs were starting on a back foot in terms of the unification system and the sort of the swallowing up, if you like, by West Germany. You know, once the wall came down, I guess, you know, they were always starting on a back foot. Gary mentioned about the training facilities, you know, so they were always at a greater disadvantage, I guess you could say.
Yes, I mean, you can look across so many of the other Eastern Bloc nations and how The freedom of movement meant that there was this huge exodus of players that went to the big leagues, not even the big leagues sometimes. They were able to earn more money playing, you know, in what we would deem to be minor European leagues compared to the top ones. And this kind of happened to the East German sides. So the wall came down, opportunity arose, but within that, you know, they were just airdropped into an absolute minefield of a league system. The way that the Oberliga was diversified, split, and placed within the existing Bundesliga and regional Liga system was, you know, cruel almost. But, you know, it was something that had to be done as part of a reunification. But for most of those clubs, there wasn't even an opportunity to play off for a place in the top division of the Bundesliga. I mean, how you could fit 14 Oberliga teams into what was an 18-team Bundesliga. You know, you were effectively asking for a 32-team top flight if you'd have absorbed them all within the top division. An impossible conundrum to come up with. But within that, two Oberliga teams went into the Bundesliga.
Just chipping in there, Stephen. In the new Bundesliga in 91-92, they did increase it to 20, but that's as far as they went.
Because they had to absorb the teams being promoted from the two Bundesliga there as well. So, I remember that integration at the time. I think it was Sky were showing Bundesliga games around about then. So, I remember all that quite vividly as it happened, and they brought them in. And there was a huge interest at that time. I remember like Dynamo Dresden, you know, showing up in the Bundesliga and being, you know, absolutely transfixed by it and how they do and you know, survive by the skin of the teeth there a couple of seasons before dropping down the divisions. So yes, this exodus of players happened to them as well, even though they were being welcomed to within this new brave Western world and division of football. So it was a case of trying to not even keep pace but hold on to the coattails of what they'd been invited to, an absolutely impossible situation.
I think it's telling when two DDR Oberliga teams were given places in the new Bundesliga at that point, there has never been more than two teams from the former East in the Bundesliga since in the 30 years since. There has simply never, I mean, not counting RB Leipzig. And for a long period, for a 10-year period, there were no Eastern teams at all in the Bundesliga. That tells you the story. They never have caught up.
Yeah, within that, you know, the names of these teams always remains immortal in some capacity because of deeds done and the mysterious, you know, Oberliga that they inhabited, you know, and then struck out into European competition. You know, for people my age, they still remain evocative names, but swallowed up by the contemporary game.
Coming to you again, you know, Gary, I suppose for the sort of the final time, and it's not, you know, do you think, I seem to be giving you the tricky questions again, but do you think not damage was done, but do you think, you know, the system that was there just set up, you know, once unification arrived, it was almost that the East German clubs were almost just set up to fail?
Yeah, I guess, I mean, not intentionally, but that, you know, that, I think that's the inevitable consequence. And, you know, hearing Michael talk about the clubs have sort of suffered since, and it obviously goes into more detail in the book. But I think this highlights the importance of books like Michael's. I mean, history is important in football, and, you know, we're saying, you know, that once it's lost, it's lost. And, you know, we talk about evocative club names. You know, we mentioned Karlsruhe Siena and Magdeburg, but Vorwärts and Karlsmarkstad. Rotation Bubbles, Berg. I mean, they're these wonderful names that, you know, they just kind of mystique around them, that, you know, it's a bit exotic. But what the book does, one of the things the book does, well, for me, is it gave me a greater affinity with these clubs that I didn't know a great deal. I mean, I don't say I know a great deal about them now, but I know a little more about them. And I think I've got a greater affection for them because of the book that Michael wrote. So, books like Michael's do a great service to football because, it's a field of the game where there isn't that much coverage. The people's game that Michael mentioned earlier, but that's a bit more academic and it's a lot less easy to read than Michael's. So it's a great way of keeping the history alive. So, well done, Michael, and thank you for that, buddy.
Thanks very much for saying that, Gary. Really, very much appreciated. I really appreciate it. And I would sort of add, if the book can do anything, it would be to encourage you fellas and anyone listening to get out there and see some matches in Germany as soon as we can. In doing my journey, I got particularly fond of what is the fourth level of German football and the first level that's regional. So the Regionalliga, which is the fourth level, the bit which is for the teams from the former East or that covers that region is the Regionalliga Nordost. And it's sort of the closest you can get really to that time, if you do want to sort of think back to it. It geographically, it covers a very similar area to what was East Germany. But also, for many of these clubs, just because of what we've just been talking about and the struggles that they've had and the catching up they've had to do, it feels like a natural level for many of them. And I think currently, I was just trying to sort it up, but I think of the 14 clubs that I've visited, currently six of them are in the Regionalliga Nordost. So I'd really recommend getting out there and supporting those clubs if you can, just for the experience, because as many listeners will know, German match day experience, particularly a bit slightly lower levels, is really, really good fun and has its own flavour and quality and good beer, obviously. So I'd really encourage people to get out and support those clubs. And I became fond of the Regionalliga Nordost, and it feels like the closest you can get to that time. Of course, that's not true. That's a romanticised version. But it feels like the closest I could get to them. But so I'd encourage that if you can get out there when we can.
Obviously, like you say, the current situation that we're in, I'm sure people are desperate to sort of absorb as much football, as possible. And I think people are going to be more willing to embrace the newfound freedom when it arrives. I think you're right. I think there's a real opportunity for people to sort of spread their wings a little bit and go and sort of make, where they can and where people can afford to make use of the sort of return to freedom and go and see and watch the things that they've missed, but maybe go and watch it from a different perspective. Michael, it's been brilliant. Brilliant having you on. Like I say, the book, The Turning Season, it was a book that I was desperate to read. Like I say, the minute I caught wind that it was coming out, it didn't disappoint. It lends itself, brilliantly to like I say, a subject that I find fascinating. Obviously, Stephen and Gary, we all find it fascinating, and it did a great job on illuminating certain stories. And like you say, it was done in such an original manner that it just made it, more and more engaging.
Thanks very much, Stuart. I really should add as well, Stephen, your book, Frozen in Time, was an inspiration. I absolutely loved it. And then since reading The Cool Kids and then Stu, your book, 1982 Brazil, I see some similarities. I've got to say, when we're going back to where we started, trying to do not necessarily different just for the sake of it, but the sort of I see you both doing something which actually refers back, and I think, Stephen, you alluded to it, refers back to your younger self. And in your book, you talk about watching the midweek sports special and the theme tune and so on. That's your in. And in your book, Stu, keep for me is absolutely anchored by the 10-year-old you. And obviously that's intentional, but it works so well. And I suppose I'm saying this because I don't want it to sound like I feel like I've written some book that's different. I think our books, I like to think that they share that in common, and that is the anchor in probably in our younger selves, whether it be the 15-year-old self watching European Cup matches on the telly, whether it be the 10-year-old Stuart watching the 1982 World Cup, or in my case, the 16-year-old me watching the Berlin Wall fall and thinking, what is that absurd thing that's happening, that, you know, that they built there? And I need to know more about that. So sort of anchoring in that, in the personal you, felt important to me, but I absolutely loved it about your books as well. So thank you for writing those. And actually, thank you for doing it from the 10-year-old Stu and the younger Stephen. You know, thank you for doing that. And on that note, I'm really looking forward, Gary, to your Dutch book. Probably for very similar reasons. There's probably some deep, you know, something that will anchor that, I'm sure, in your your history with watching that football.
Bless you. Thanks for that, mate.
Oh, very kind, Michael. Very kind.
It is, and like I say, a wise Scouse man once said to me, "Just read the book you want to read," and that was it. And,
that, and I think Steve that, know that wise Scouse man.
I think he might do. Yeah, he might live near him. Yeah, you do. You just. The first thing is just write what you love or what you know, and yeah, you kind of go from there.
Yeah, it is. It's a case of kind of like, I don't know, how something feels, you know, and how it made you feel and when it made you feel, and that's where, you know, it springs from. But yeah, I agree with what you say in reverse there, Michael. You know, there's so much that I read of your book and thought, yeah, this is brilliant, and it's a great way to kind of cross the streams. There's a sense of there's football history, but it's not textbook. It's a way of putting it across where there's a bit of opinion in there. There's a bit of mischief in there, almost. You know, there's some life breathed into it that's multifaceted. And Michael, your book's wonderful.
Football can be a bit silly. We don't, you know, we don't have to take it too seriously, do we? So
exactly. You know, I've said to once upon a time that, you know, I could never really explain the way I write, and because I've been asked a few times, I've had to have to think about it, and it's a case of saying, well, look, you know, I can't take you to a topic, but I can put my arm around you and say, look, this is what I've spotted from my cockeyed angle of it. And yeah, it's the, yeah, and that's the only way I can do it. And, you know, I've picked that up in your book as well there, Michael, which I think is just a brilliant, brilliant read.
Yeah, it's, like I say, it's been brilliant. And people who, it's certainly a book that a younger generation need to get a look at and need to get a hold of. Certainly, you know, it's something they're never going to see again. This is not a cyclical thing. This is a piece of history. And, you know, and if you're a fan of football, or you have a keen sense of history for football, then, you know, it's definitely a must-read text. Gary, thank you for joining us.
No worries, Matthew. Always happy to spend an hour or so talking about my favourite football subject in life, which is football, with my mates. And, you know, Michael's book has been wonderful to read, and a great chat about it as well.
Brilliant. Stephen, as like we said, you know, right up your street, this one.
Oh, perfect. Just one of the best we've done, this one.
And Michael, like I said before, you know, just thank you ever so much for joining us. Like I said, I told you that the gratitude and the privilege was all ours.
No, I really do appreciate it. I've thoroughly enjoyed myself rambling on to you. I hope I didn't send you to sleep. But I'm going to leave you now and get cracking on with from Leipzig to Ludlow. I got to get on with it.
Oh, we'll put you in for a return podcast, Michael.
Brilliant.
It's a verbal contract now, Michael. There's no backing out to be told.
Yeah, I've left it running. It's still recording. I've not signed off yet. And all that's left me to say on that bombshell and promise of a second book is for me to say thank you for listening. And please join us again next time on the Lob Podcast with These Football Times. Thank you and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the Lob, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.